Welcome to the Big Three Podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome back to the Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church. And for the next half hour, your host, as we unpack those three big questions from Sunday. On Sunday, we continued in our series Encounter, the Olive Tree Media Resource, and looking at Jesus' encounter with the excluded, in particular, the example in Matthew chapter 8 of Jesus healing a leper, a man who was by definition excluded from normal society, and who Jesus healed after the man came to Jesus and said, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." And Margie Robertson, who oversees our serve team and our operations here at the church, was speaking. And she spoke about the, in particular, the isolation that this man would have felt and the willingness of Jesus to reach out and the various ways in which we can end up excluding ourselves one way or another, and that Jesus is nonetheless willing. The one proviso, if I can put it that way, that she included was that there was a little bit of bravery or faith that was required for the man to actually approach Jesus and ask his question. There was a similar kind of bravery required of us to come to Jesus, who, as the story demonstrates, is willing. So out of that, there were a handful of questions that were raised about that. So the first is, the exclusion of the leper seems to be primarily religious, so wrapped around uncleanliness, rather than medical. Why wasn't health the focus? Secondly, this healing is also recorded in Mark and Luke. Why is each account a little different? Which is a good question. When Margie and I were chatting a bit about the sermon preparation, when she was kind of working her way through the text and whatnot, we reflected a little bit on the differences between the stories. The ways in which Mark tells it, it's a little bit different than the way Matthew tells it, which is a little bit different than the way Luke tells it. So that's a good question to engage with. And then, why would Jesus tell the man not to tell anyone what had happened to him? Would that even be possible? Which is, I think it's the, if it's not, I wouldn't say obvious, but it's. I think it's the clear question. Jesus heals someone. He had leprosy. Now he does not. He had to live outside the town. Now he does not. I mean, what was he supposed to say when he came back into the town? Was Jesus expecting him to lie and say, "Oh, you know, I got better"? You know, like, what's going on in that space? But it's a good question to ask, because it happens that line, that idea that Jesus tells people not to tell anyone, occurs fairly frequently in the gospel accounts. And so it's worth taking some time to reflect on that. So those are the questions that we're going to tackle today. Looking forward to doing that. So let's get stuck in. So Margie opened her sermon with a fairly extensive reflection on the social isolation that the leper would have experienced. Now, there may have been other people who were unclean with whom he was, you know, isolating, so to speak. But there was a social and a religious exclusion that would have been quite profound, even if he did have a small colony of people who he lived with. The idea of being outside of the village and cut off from normal life. And in particular, that was related to the idea that the leprosy was not primarily treated as a contagious disease. And you should have, just as an aside, you should have in your Bibles a little footnote or a textual note next to the word leprosy in your Bible. And it should say something about the fact that this word doesn't mean leprosy like we know it today. I think it's called Hansen's disease is the kind of the official, it's not the medical name, but it's the more common name for what we would now call leprosy. Whereas in the biblical texts, leprosy kind of stands in for all sorts of skin diseases. So we don't know exactly what it was that he had. But nonetheless, this idea that leprosy was not seen primarily as an infectious disease, but that it was a state of uncleanliness, and that was the primary reason for exclusion. And so the question is, the exclusion of the leper seems to be primarily religious, so uncleanliness, rather than medical. Why wasn't health the focus? You know, we're so used to treating infectious diseases as infectious diseases. We don't attach any kind of religious significance to those illnesses in the same way. I did think, you know, when we were going through COVID, I mean, not that we're done with COVID, but when we were really going through COVID, there was a sense that if you had COVID, you were unclean, right? You were expected to isolate and isolate quite significantly in the early stages, right? To, you know, be in a particular area of the house and not interact with those around you so that they didn't catch it. And there was a sense that, you know, wearing masks and all those things, there was a sense that while there was no moral, how would I put it? There was no moral judgment on that. Like, if you caught COVID, you weren't a wicked person, right? Like, you weren't evil. You just got COVID. But there was still a sense that it was appropriate for you not to be there. So Margie did some really good work in helping us understand cleanliness and uncleanliness wrapped around things being in the wrong spot. You know, so she used the example of the no shirt, no shoes, no service. And if you are on the beach and you don't have a shirt on and you don't have your shoes on, that's appropriate. You are, shall I say, clean to be dressed that way. But if you go into a shop with just your bathers on, then you're unclean because it's not appropriate. Tim McBride, who's the principal at Moreland College, uses this example, which I think is quite clever, very Tim, really, of dirt. He says that dirt that is in the garden is clean. Dirt that is in the house is unclean, right? And we might go, yes, it's unclean in lots of ways. But that's a good example. Like the dirt, the dirt's not the problem. It's where it is. Now, that doesn't answer the question, which is wrapped around why is the focus on the religious component, the ritualistic component, that someone who probably would have benefited from medical treatment rather than exclusion. Like, why was the religious emphasis so important? The laws that we find in Leviticus wrapped around uncleanliness in all of its variations, right, including unclean and clean food, the various states that people find themselves in when they are ritually unclean and not appropriate for entry into the tabernacle. The focus is there also on the religious component. And the focus was, in particular in Leviticus, is that God was in the midst of the camp. He was in his dwelling place in the tabernacle. And so the community of faith needed to be, or the community of Israel surrounding the Lord, who were in covenant relationship with him, needed to behave and look and act in certain ways. And so the cleanliness codes were wrapped around that. In all of them, the emphasis on the health components is simply not mentioned. So clean and unclean food is a good example. Some people will look at the lists and they'll say, well, this was about protecting the people of Israel, that, you know, pork has a greater likelihood of going bad or whatever it is. I'm not too fussed with the details of that, but that, you know, the seafood piece, and there's other bits and pieces where you're like, oh, there's health benefits to eating what they ate and whatnot. But that's not the emphasis. God doesn't say to Moses, give the people these food laws because it's really good for their health. They'll live longer and their arteries won't get clogged. And it is that ritualistic component. Now, there may be health benefits to it, but the bigger principle is about the discernment and about the community and how the community ought to look. Now, that gives some background, really, to what's happening in the gospel account with the exclusion of this leper, primarily wrapped around, you know, his physical state, but also the ritual state, right, in terms of his religion, the religious situation. The health focus, yeah, is secondary in it. And I guess the best way to answer it, to tell you the truth, is just to say that the ancient world looked at health concerns very differently than we do. Their understanding of health was very different than ours. What they called medicine probably wasn't quite what we would call medicine. Like there's a very, it's one of the big gaps in terms of how they saw the world and how we would see the world. So I think that's part of it. I also think it's valuable to recognize that, you know, there was a health component. Like if these were infectious skin diseases in particular, then excluding people was actually fairly important. So there was probably an element of that health focus there. In the gospel accounts, though, I think that the emphasis on those who are outsiders, right? And a lot of the people that Jesus encounters are outsiders in one way or another. The leper was an outsider because of his physical condition, and an outsider quite literally in terms of where and how he had to live. And Jesus, well, welcomes him in. You know, if you are willing, you can make me clean. I am willing. And he reached out and touched him. And you find that in the, you know, the tax collectors that he calls to follow him, and in those whom he heals and interacts with throughout the Gospels, there's this sense of including people who the religious establishment considered outside of the kingdom. Because remember, Jesus came preaching the kingdom. And I think that that lens helps us make some sense of some of these stories. That Matthew's interest, for instance, isn't really in the physical health. It's more about the identity of Jesus and the boundaries, shall we say, of the people of God. And the boundaries are a lot broader than many Jewish people thought in the New Testament. You even find that amongst the disciples. And the border is also not ethnic. Jesus goes to great lengths to demonstrate that it's not just about being born Jewish that allows you to enter into the kingdom, that there is a lifestyle, there's an attitude, there's a heart condition, there's behaviors, right, that are part of the kingdom of God, and that faith in him and a life lived following him is ultimately the criteria for entering the kingdom. So I think that wider religious framework is also part of the reason why the focus isn't so much on the health. Luke, in his gospel account, which is almost leading into our second question, but in his gospel, actually in the book of Acts, is it in the book of Acts? Should have looked this up. I believe it might be at the end of Colossians, where Paul refers to him as our friend, like our doctor friend Luke. And many commentators believe that that's referring to the Luke who wrote the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. And there are a couple of places in Luke's account where, shall we say, that medical background may be evident. In the story of the woman with the bleed, which we're actually going to be looking at in a couple weeks' time, Mark's account, for instance, goes into great detail about how she had basically paid doctors heaps of money and none of them had helped her. They were totally useless. She just got worse. And Luke leaves that part out. He leaves out the doctors are not very good bit. And so some commentators think that might have been a bit of self-protection in that sense. But nonetheless, the religious components, the ritualistic components, the kingdom of heaven, the inclusion of the outsiders in the kingdom, I think is the emphasis. And it's also, I think, part of the emphasis in the Old Testament laws around that as well. So I hope that makes some sense. It's a good question. And it's one, as I said, where we really are confronted with a very different worldview. Like the way in which health was dealt with in the ancient world is just like chalk and cheese to how we would think about health today. And so part of it is about trying to work out the gap between them. And then part of it is trying to work out the emphasis within the accounts, the ways in which they are told to us and the emphasis that they hold. So I almost stumbled into this early, right? But this healing is also recorded in Mark and Luke. Why is each account a little different? So in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, those three Gospels are often referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. They tell the story of Jesus from a similar perspective. So syn, in which we might get words like synonym, you know, words that have the same meaning, and optic, from which we get words around optics, right? They tell the perspective, they tell the story of Jesus from the same perspective. And there are a number of, I'm not even going to say clues, there's a whole bunch of evidence that suggests that Matthew and Luke in particular actually had access to Mark's gospel when they wrote theirs, that Mark's gospel may very well have been the first gospel written, and that Matthew and Luke included it. So Luke, in his introduction, talks about the how he had carefully researched everything, which I'm sure included talking to people who had been there. He was writing fairly early in the piece. He may have had access to other sources as well. And, you know, biblical scholarship would suggest that there was another source out there, but I won't get into that today. And the stories that are told and the general order of them are generally the same in those three accounts, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They all start with John the Baptist and Jesus's baptism. There's a sense that his ministry, even if it took longer than 1 year, that there's only one journey to Jerusalem. In John's account, Jesus goes three times, at least over 3 years, to Jerusalem, whereas there's not that same kind of timeline in the synoptic accounts. And the kind of the bottom line is that the authors of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, selected their material to tell a particular story about Jesus, right? To emphasize a particular component of who he was and what his life, death, and resurrection meant. They arranged that material in particular ways. So in all three accounts, the story of the healing of the leper is fairly early. But in Mark's account, it's very early. I think it's still in chapter one. It's the first major healing. Jesus has healed Peter's mother-in-law and then has healed a bunch of people who came to the door. But this is the first kind of detailed healing that we have. In Matthew's account, as we reflected on Sunday, it's after the Sermon on the Mount. So there's this big block of teaching, and then there's a series of healings. In Luke's account, it's still early, but a little bit later than, say, in Mark's account. So they've selected the stories that they feel are the most substantial, right? John, at the end of his gospel, says Jesus did so much, you could fill books and books and books and books and books. But these things we've selected, right, that I've selected in my gospel account, right, tell you about Jesus and are written so that you may believe in him. And to some degree, that's true of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that they've selected those things, they've arranged them in particular ways. And then they've told the stories with, shall we say, just slightly different emphases, depending, again, I think, on their overall purpose. In Mark's account, for instance, and the differences aren't major, right? They're not major. In Mark's account, the leper comes to Jesus and says, you know, if you're willing, you can make me clean. And we're told that Jesus was indignant. And we assume that he was indignant, not with the man, because that's not compatible with how we see Jesus in the rest of the Gospels, but indignant at the sickness, at the fact that someone would actually have to say, "Are you willing?" Those sorts of things, and heals him, and then sternly warns him not to tell anybody. And then the story concludes by saying, but the man went out and told everybody, and so Jesus couldn't actually go into towns anymore. He had to hang out in kind of wilderness places. Matthew doesn't include the indignation of Jesus. He includes the warning, but kind of takes the sternness out of it. And then he doesn't include the reference to the man telling everybody. In Luke's account, again, I don't think there's the indignation, but he does say that the man told people. And so there's this kind of similarity, but differences in the stories. So in terms of the question, you know, why are they a little bit different? It has to do primarily with the purposes that the authors had. Now, I'm not sure that there's any real answer to why they left out some of the details that they did. But for whatever reason, they didn't feel that that was absolutely necessary for them. I mean, in Mark's account, for instance, the stern warning not to tell anyone, that's kind of it is the first time Jesus says that, right? So there's something, I think, striking about its location. And it also sets up the fact that Jesus almost immediately was being mobbed by people and needed to stay kind of outside of the town. So it kind of sets up what we find in the rest of the gospel. So I think that the differences are linked to purpose and are linked to the ideas that the authors were seeking to really emphasize in their portraits of Jesus, these synoptic pictures. Mark's account tends to be, when Matthew, Mark, and Luke tell the same story, Mark's account seems to be the longest, and then Matthew and Luke generally kind of change some of the details and its location in the story to kind of fit their wider purposes, if Mark's gospel was the first one written. As I said, there's some evidence to suggest that that's the case, but obviously we weren't there, and we don't have any of the kind of autographed copies that have a date at the top or something, and they weren't copyrighted like they are today. So this is kind of our best guess of it. But that's essentially when you come across the stories in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, particularly the ones that are similar, you find that the arrangement and the selection and the way in which it's told often fits more broadly into the depiction of Jesus. Mark's account, for instance, Jesus is a man of action. He uses the Greek word for immediately, like 40 times or something. Like everything happens right away in Mark's gospel. And Jesus is just doing things. Like there's this kind of action, this kind of this kind of ongoing action until we get to the last week of Jesus' life when everything really slows down. We don't have a lot of blocks of teaching in Mark's gospel until that last week of Jesus' life. Matthew's gospel, on the other hand, has much larger sections of teaching. He seems to have had a more Jewish audience in mind, even though he has some of the broadest definitions around who is included in the kingdom. So he includes the story of the Magi, for instance, and the wise men in the birth narratives, who are outsiders who nonetheless recognize what's happening, and it's the Great Commission that sends the disciples to all nations. Luke's account is the first part of a two-parter, so it leads into the book of Acts. So he's wanting to lead us to the story of the church. He also has an emphasis on the universal application of the gospel. And there's a whole bunch of other differences and specific focuses that you find within the gospels as well. So that's a little bit of biblical criticism, so to speak, looking at the texts as texts and trying to figure out where the similarities and if the similarities are coincidental or whether they were purposeful, whether there was actually a kind of a shared source. And I think in this case that there probably was. It has often struck me that, I mentioned John's statement that these things, that Jesus did so much we could have filled books of it. But these are the things that we told. And I think if Jesus did, let me exaggerate for the point of making the purpose. If Jesus did a million things, or even just 1,000 things, let's just kind of, if there were 1,000 healing accounts where there's an interaction between them and Jesus and whatnot, it's often struck me that there are so few stories told in the gospel accounts. It's almost as if the disciples, as they began to teach in the early Christian movement, decided and determined that these stories are essential Jesus. Like, of all the things that we could tell you about Jesus, these are the essential things you need to know. The fact that there are three accounts that are told from a very similar perspective, that include many of the same stories. Like from the very beginning, the church included all three of them, all four of the gospels, right? These stories are essential Jesus. That Matthew and Luke, I suppose, could have included different stories because there would have been heaps of them, but they chose this one because, again, there was something about this story that is essential Jesus. I've often been struck by that, that this is what you needed to know. And that these stories that we find in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these teachings, like this is the very heart of it. When you kind of boil it all down, this is the stuff you need to know. So the Gospels provide us with, I think, a remarkable reflection on what was the most important stuff about Jesus. These aren't random stories. These have been very purposefully pulled together, the essential Jesus. And so the differences are part of what we have to kind of grapple with as we make our way through it. So again, hope that's helpful as we continue on with our third question today. At the very end of the story, Jesus tells the man not to tell anyone what has happened to him, but to go and do the proper sacrifices according to the law. And the second part makes sense for us, right? Jesus was a law-abiding Jew. He came to fulfill the law, and so the law had certain stipulations around returning to regular society, being not interviewed by, but checked out by the priest, being confirmed as clean, offering his sacrifice, re-entering normal society. So it's not surprising that Jesus would encourage him to do that. But it is a little bit strange that Jesus would say, don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone what's happened to you. And, you know, the question is wrapped around not only why would he do that, but is that even possible? And I, you know, I'm not sure that Jesus would have wanted him to lie. I don't know what he expected the man to do when people asked him, you know, how did you become clean? Because that doesn't happen very often, right? There's only one other account of a leper being healed, and that's in the Old Testament. The example of the Aramean military commander Naaman. And when the king of Aram sends him with a letter to the king of Israel saying, hey, can you heal my general of leprosy? The king of Israel tears his robes and says, am I God? Like, this was not something that you could do, right? So there's this real sense that leprosy was incurable. And so the idea that this man would just kind of show back up in his neighborhood and kind of go, hey, look at me, I'm better. And people say, what happened? And he's like, oh, you know, I just woke up one day and it was gone. It just seems like a hard line to follow. I think there are a number of other places. I think there's places where like people are raised from the, I think it's Jairus' daughter, and Jesus says, don't tell anyone. And you're like, everyone knows she was dead. How do you not tell anyone? Anyway, the bigger question is, ultimately, why did Jesus say, don't tell people? Don't tell them what's happened. And I think there's probably two reasons. In Mark's gospel, Jesus, very, very early in his ministry, chapter 1, heals Simon Peter's mother-in-law of a fever, and she gets up and begins to serve them. And then at the end of the Sabbath, as the sun goes down, basically everyone comes to the door and Jesus heals them all. And then the next morning, we're told Jesus goes out to pray. And no one realizes he's gone. Everyone's looking for him. The disciples find him and basically say, everyone's looking for you. And it seems that, you know, that what they want is for him to keep healing people. And Jesus says, we're not doing that. I've come to teach. I've come to preach. So we're going to go to the surrounding villages and talk about the good news. So I think that part of it is that Jesus wanted to some degree to downplay the miraculous, right? Because he had come to teach and to proclaim the kingdom. And you know, particularly in John's gospel, but you find it in all four gospels, the miracles are not as effective as we might think in creating faith, right? So, I'm more familiar with Mark's gospel. But in Mark's gospel, Jesus performs all these miracles, and the Pharisees, the religious leaders, basically say the only reason he's doing this, the only reason he can cast out demons, for instance, is because he himself is demon-possessed. You're like, okay, so he has set someone free, and says that he's doing it in the name of God, right? On behalf of God as an expression of the kingdom. And it's been completely and utterly misconstrued. Completely and utterly misconstrued. So I think Jesus is also aware that that's the case, right? That the miracles are not necessarily going to bring about faith. And he's interested in faith. He's interested in the response of faith. And so I think there's a downplaying just of the miraculous in general in order to focus on the big parts of his ministry. The other reason, though, because this is often described by scholars as the messianic secret, right? The secret of being the Messiah. And the clearest description of that that I've kind of heard is this. By the time or when Jesus shows up, he was not the first person in Jewish history to have to be named the Messiah. There had been a number of other, well, pretenders, obviously, from the light of historical perspective, who had claimed to be the Messiah. And they had, you know, gathered a group of people around them, and they'd ended up getting into trouble. And usually that was really bad trouble. There was a Messiah figure when Jesus would have been very young, right, in and around the area of Nazareth and Galilee. And the Romans just came down on it like a ton of bricks and apparently just crucified like hundreds of people up and down the roads. So there would have been these symbols of Roman authority and the kind of the crushing of this messianic uprising. So when Jesus shows up, I mean, he's not interested at all, like at all, in raising an army. He's not interested at all in trying to boot Rome out of Israelite territory. He's not interested in being a king in the way in which the people wanted him to be a king. And so the line of argument goes that Jesus was uncomfortable. I'm not sure that's the right word, but he was uncomfortable with being labeled the Messiah when the meaning of that word was the meaning ascribed by the crowds. Right, so if people began to say that you're the Messiah, then people would be gathered to him who would want him to raise an army. They'd want to make him king. In fact, at one point, they tried to make him king after feeding the 5,000, and he kind of sends them away and kind of retreats up the mountain. There's a sense that Jesus wants to avoid the baggage of the term Messiah in the first century context. So one of the pieces in the story which makes some sense of this is that when Jesus finally begins to teach his disciples that he must die, it's after Peter has finally said, "You are the Messiah." And then Jesus begins to redefine what that means. Right? So Jesus, you know, Peter says, "You're the Messiah. You're the Christ. You're the anointed one. You're the one that God is sending to kind of make everything right." And Jesus goes to great lengths to basically say, okay, well, to be the Messiah means that I have to suffer. And I need to die, I need to rise again. And the disciples just can't get their head around it. So the idea is that whenever Jesus says to someone, listen, don't tell people what's happened, I don't think it was so much about don't tell them that you've been healed by someone. It was more about just don't be telling them that I'm the Messiah, because they will inevitably think that the Messiah is this military, priestly, kingly something or other. Right? They've got their own image of what that looks like, and that's not the kind of Messiah figure that I am. So that seems to be, and I think that's fairly plausible in the way the story is told for us in particular. So anyway, thank you for those questions, and looking forward to this coming Sunday as we continue the Encounter series. Roxanne Lawler, our associate, will be speaking this Sunday. I can't remember the topic off the top of my head, to tell you the truth. So it'll be a surprise, well, for all of us, I suppose, and looking forward to the questions that might be raised from that, and look forward to you joining me again next week for the Big Three. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.